And Per Zetterberg from Uppsala University is already here on stage. Welcome. You are Associate Professor of Political Science, and your research is focused on political recruitment, political representation, and gender quota implementation. So very relevant perspectives could be added, of course, to the conclusions and the findings that Rachel just presented. So we look forward very much to hear your reflections on what we've just heard. Thank you.
Thank you, Julia. Thank you for coming and for inviting me. Like Julia was saying, I have pretty much knowledge in some of these areas, but less knowledge in other areas. So it's been a very interesting read, and I've learned a lot by reading this report, especially on education and labor market and non-women groups, so to speak, if those exist. that I know less about. So I'm going to talk a little bit first about, from a research perspective, what are the key lessons learned? And some of them in these, my comments will be quite similar to what we just heard. And then I'm going to try to do two sets of reflections, try to qualify a little bit some of these, the content of the report, and so on. So that's pretty much what I plan to do. So very briefly starting up with at least from my perspective, was like the key lessons learned as a researcher. I really liked first the multiple approaches to combat discrimination and to think about working with them simultaneously. So they are both like institutional reforms such as legal change and quotas and reservations, but also more like attitudinal change, cultural change, campaigns of that sort, and economic measures. When doing research, we tend to focus perhaps on one of these quite often. So I really like this more like holistic and comprehensive approach. Which is useful to think about. Perhaps like the like one overall finding was to see that these measures could increase access to education, labor market, and political institutions. And so in a way, putting it a bit roughly, I would say it's quite easy to get the numbers right. So it's quite easy to get like women in political assemblies. It's quite easy to get women to get people from marginalized groups into higher education and so on. But it's a bit more complicated when you try to also transform these institutions like labor markets and educational systems and political systems. Just because these institutions are very sticky and attitudes and culture is also not that easy to change. I would like to add one thing also, like why it's difficult to change policy and also to change these institutions and eradicate discrimination within these institutions and also work for these social groups and so on. I would say that one also have to have in mind like the incentive structures of people who are like being elected into political institutions, for example, because they have a certain kind of like double bind. They have to think about both their own career, so to speak, and also to support their group that they represent, and to handle these things is quite complicated. It's not that easy always to make these transformative changes. As we heard also, there was some positive impact on poverty. And here I would like to add one thing that is not in the report, which is on political reservations for women, where we've seen also also outside of India, we've seen that when you get women in through these reservations, you also tend to see more spending on health issues, which is quite interesting. And although we operate here at a different level than looking at the individual level and constituent level, so on, we see this shift, and it's also beneficial for women's health. So I think these are more like macro studies that are like global, but driven by low and middle income countries, that I think is interesting also to continue looking at. Another thing that I found interesting was to think about also like, are the poorest people, are they beneficiaries of these measures? And I think here research has a lot to think about, because we I guess it's also about like what level do we look at? We look at constituency or like state or and so on. And it's sometimes difficult to go below these levels. I found that very interesting and important. Another thing, intersecting inequalities that are not addressed by affirmative action measures, as stated in the report. And I think these are also very important findings, because we know that women are not just women, disabled people are not just disabled people, or ethnic minorities are not just ethnic minorities, but we also see that they tend to intersect with class, for example. And how do you do that? And it connects quite a lot to the previous point about the poorest people. You see it, that they tend to intersect, and what to do about that. It's important to have that in mind, I would say. And finally, I think key lesson I think of from a researcher's perspective, at least, is this thing about losers and backlash, and this and the fact that it's Rachel was talking about it's a highly sensitive policy area, and I think it's very important to have that in mind. Because at least when it comes to higher education and labor markets and politics, there are potential losers, people losing from these reforms when they are targeted, I would say, when they are targeted reforms. Perhaps less so when you have these broader educational reforms, but at least when it comes to labor market and higher education and politics, there are positions that are being lost. That might create backlash. It might also create backlash when the merit system is kind of being in flux. When people think that a system into higher education, a system into labor market, a system into politics is based on merits, and they believe that the merits are kind of like neutral, so to speak. And when you then have these targeted measures to get people from marginalized groups into to this area, then it creates negative attitudes and hostility towards these reforms. So how should we evaluate these findings? I would say, are these good or bad news that we heard today? I think it depends, and I think it depends very much on what expectations do we have, because many of these reforms, not all of them are explicitly aimed at eradicating poverty. So I think we have to look at the kind of like the politics behind these anti-discrimination measures. So what's the problem? And what's the solution and what's the goal? And I think that also makes it important for what kind of expectations should we have. I would say when it comes to, for example, what I know best from politics and political reservations, I would say perhaps poverty eradication would be like a positive side effect. Because when it comes to, for example, gender, a main reason for having these targeted measures, so to speak, is to to kind of like overcome previous injustices. So it's more about like a justice issue, and less so what they less so about what exactly are they gonna do. Whereas, for example, when it comes to education and those kinds of measures, past poverty is more directly part of the problem. So I would say that there are quite different features of these three investigated areas that we should have in mind. And then I was also talking about, like, should backlash stop us from using targeted measures? Sometimes in the report I kind of like read a little bit that into I think there is always counter reactions when you have these very highly politicized measures. So there will always be like a step forward and then two steps back, and then we see eventually perhaps there will be three steps forward. There is some evidence that actually things are being changed after you see this backlash. So finally, a few words also about strategies. Which strategies should we use? And I think in order to address that question, I think we should unpack the concept of discrimination to find proper measures, because discrimination is a multi-dimensional concept. So it's not like something like unitary. And I have four different phases of gender-related discrimination that I build on Bjørnegaard's work. But I think it could be actually also considered from other social groups as well. So I bring them all together due to shorter time. One phase of discrimination, I think it's instrumental, and it's like you discriminate people from labor market or from higher education, for labor market or for politics, because they lack the material assets or the networks needed to get recruited. Another phase of discrimination would be like more expressive or emotional motives. The feeling of comfort, the feeling of trust. People you tend to trust are also those that are look more like you. So if you're from the majority group, you tend to trust those that look more like you. So the discrimination is based more on like these emotional motives. And the third group is more like the outright sexist or like racist, so to speak, motives, like where you delegitimize the presence of women or marginalized groups because they are women. And then the fourth one is more like the patriarchal one, like you have a structure that is gendered, the gendered biased system of merits. It could also be transferred to ethnically divided countries and so on. So I think you have to think about all these sorts of things in order to come up with proper measures, because if the problem here for the discrimination, the nature of discrimination is different, then you have to think about that when designing your measures. And finally, you have to match that kind of discrimination with a specific solution. I can come back to that later on if you want to. And then to think about the importance of context. I think it's so relevant that this match is also matched to the specific country or part of the country to get things right and to find the right solution. I think I stopped there, and thank you.
Thank you so much, Pat. Can I just ask, sort of as a matter of clarification, and perhaps also because I'm struggling with a little bit myself in my own work, the whole concept of intersectional discrimination, sort of you passed through it and you saw that there's a relevance to look at it while doing interventions. But then do you have any sort of example of actually how to deal with that fact? Or is it, in fact, perhaps even useless to look at groups, specific groups, as groups, and in terms of representation? Are there other ways of dealing with that matter?
So you mean like if there are like examples of, yeah, of where you have,
I mean, that instead of targeting women sort of as a group,
yeah,
and I think it might be interesting, and later when we talk about the more universal aspects of as a first means of including everyone, but as a very practical level, it becomes a bit challenging in terms of looking at groups and the intersectional dimensions of discrimination, and I'm wondering if perhaps, because we see and recognize that that's necessary,
yeah,
should we stop looking at groups as groups and looking at their representation of groups?
It's a good question.
I should say that Per told me before, so that I'm a researcher, I will not have answers.
Yeah, that's here. A good
So I'm putting you on the spot.
That's a good part of being a researcher.
But you might have thoughts. Yeah. Or do you want to think about it for a while?
Yeah, I think I'll do that.
Yeah?
Yeah.